Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and let's together now listen to a voice from the front lines of the Ebola crisis, saving one human being at a time in a clinic in Liberia. Here's the latest dispatch from Dr. Adam Levine.
You know, working so closely with our Liberian staff here, and you know, the vast majority, almost 90% of our staffing at the ETU is local Liberian staff. You know, we sort of forget sometimes like how much more they are affected by this epidemic. One of our patients, Comfort, who's a nurse, several of our staff actually worked with her at Phoebe Hospital and were colleagues with her before she became ill. And so they have that direct connection in a way that I think most of us expats don't.
The story there of Comfort, the ailing nurse, and Adam Levine, the courageous doctor, speaking to us.
The courageous men and women fighting on the front lines of this disease have told us what they need. They need more beds, they need more supplies, they need more health workers, and they need all of this as fast as possible.
Was President Obama speaking about Comfort the ailing nurse and Adam the doctor when he gave his speech this week before the UN General Assembly? I think he certainly was. We begin this hour and end this week in the trenches of the Ebola crisis. Dr. Adam Levine, you will recall, is an emergency physician from Rhode Island and a volunteer with the International Medical Corps. He's been filing daily diaries for The Takeaway from isolated Bong County, Liberia, where people arrive at his clinic infected, dying, some hopeful, some past hope. Each day is different.
We have a couple sicker patients right now. We're giving them IV fluids and hoping that it'll help them pull through. You know, probably about a third of the patients with Ebola will get better and survive even if we did nothing for them or did very little for them other than feed them and give them water. About a third of the patients will probably die no matter what we do. And then there are about a third of the patients in the middle that, you know, our interventions, I think, really make a difference. And even basic things like intravenous fluids end up helping patients pull through and support them. We have several patients here who I'm sure if they'd been admitted to one of the ETUs in Monrovia, where they're not giving IV fluids, that they wouldn't have survived. So it feels kind of good to be able to be part of that.
Another voice now. We spoke to her in New York earlier this week, and by now she, too, is on the ground in Liberia. Nancy Lindbergh, Assistant Administrator of the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. It's heading up the massive interagency task to make real these words of President Obama this week.
We are not moving fast enough. We are not doing enough. There's still a significant gap between where we are and where we need to be.
Nancy Lindbergh is personally responsible for closing that gap and meeting those goals of President Obama.
We have a whole of government effort on the ground in Liberia. The response is being led by the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, which is part of the U.S. Agency for International Development. And we have what is called a disaster assistance response team that includes USAID, CDC, Health and Human Services. We have the Forest Service because they are the experts at the incident command management, and of course DOD. So we're really pulling across the U.S. government to ensure that we have all of the best of our capabilities to put to work.
A lot of people have described that in infectious disease cases, technology, particularly social media, tracking individuals, the ability to use cell networks has been very, very useful. Is that part of the toolkit that we're using in West Africa?
Absolutely. We're both looking at strategies to provide the kind of isolation and treatment that is so critical, but coupled with that kind of community outreach, social messaging, everything from radio dramas to use of cell phones where there is cell phone penetration. Parts of the country are more difficult to reach with cell phones. But it's all the ways in which families and communities have the kind of information that can help them do things differently and then better protect their families. Things like basic hygiene and sanitation to control the infection. different burial practices so that they aren't washing the bodies of patients, family members who have died from Ebola.
Dietary restrictions, the relying of people on bush protein, wild meat, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. I mean, as the suspicion is that this was originated by somebody eating a fruit bat in Guinea. And so it is about better preparation, better cooking, washing of hands. It's all of those kinds of practices that, if changed, will enable those countries and those communities to better protect themselves from future outbreaks.
Is there a chain of command problem here? It's often been described that the USAID folks ride on, you know, military transport planes, and the generals fly in on G6s, and that it's not necessarily the case that USAID is able to organize a mobilization like this, and that the Pentagon basically runs its own operation. How's that going to work in West Africa and Liberia particularly?
You know, we have learned a lot from some of these big major responses, starting with the Indian tsunami, followed by Haiti. And what we just saw with the Philippines typhoon is an excellent coordination, much better understanding of each other's capabilities and approaches. And so the U.S. military is very clear that they are in support of the USAID response that is coordinating very closely with the international community, the United Nations, and supporting the efforts of the country governments. And what we've also become very clear about is there are capabilities that only the U.S. military has. And it's that unique scale, the ability to go in at scale quickly with lift capacity, logistics, supply chain management. Those are essential capabilities that will be important for moving us quickly ahead in this response that USAID and DOD have become much more clear about how to work together to employ those.
Some of the uniformed senior officers at AFRICOM, who were taking the lead in part of this relief effort at the Pentagon, have suggested that you know, at this moment, with what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria to a certain extent, that there's a lot on the line in this Ebola crisis. The Pentagon really wants to win one here, and that there's an emotional stake in this that, you know, they haven't necessarily seen in the last 10 years. Do you share that? Do you see that?
You know, I'm focused on the fact that we are doing this Ebola response at a time where we have three other highest level humanitarian emergencies globally. And you mentioned some of them, but I would add South Sudan, Central Africa Republic, Syria, now Ebola, not to mention Iraq, Afghanistan, some of these others. So we are at a point where the number of global crises are really stretching the humanitarian system, both in terms of resources and personnel. We can get ahead of the Ebola crisis. This one is a matter of moving quickly enough so that we can get in and bend the curve of infection. So it is a very mobilizing understanding that we can move this one. We can beat this.
This is winnable.
This is winnable.
Nancy Lindborg is Assistant Administrator of the United States Agency for International Development. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
But once again, beyond the prepositioned supplies, the skids of food and medicine, the vehicles and construction equipment to restore hospitals and clinics, the battle against Ebola is about health practitioners, nurses, and doctors stepping into harm's way and trying to turn the chilling numbers in the Ebola fight, turn those numbers around.
I was sitting down this evening just chatting with one of our new physician assistants, who's really great. He, you know, he was talking a little bit about physician assistant school in Liberia, and we were talking about his course and how long it was, and, you know, asked him how many physician assistants were in his class. I was just curious how big his class was. And he answered, there were 21 in my class, but now we are 17. And it turns out that four of his classmates from his physician assistant program have died of Ebola. And yet he's here working, you know, right next to me in the Ebola treatment unit. And I mean, the amount of courage that that takes, having lost four of your classmates to the disease and then, you know, being here every day working to treat it. It's pretty amazing, really.
Dr. Adam Levine, Bong County, Liberia, September 23rd.
Hi, my name is Alyssa Curtis. I'm calling in response to Dr. Adam Levine's Ebola audio diary. I'm a PA student here in Rhode Island, and I just wanted to let him and his family know that the PA class here at Johnson & Wales supports him and is very grateful for him. We look up to him and wish him the best of luck. Thanks.
Some thanks for Dr. Levine from the many takeaway listeners following his stories. And we'll leave you with President Obama's words on how important the fight against Ebola is for reminding the people of the world about America's global mission.
This is as important a national security priority for my team as anything else that's out there. We'll do our part. We will continue to lead, but this has to be a priority for everybody else. We cannot do this alone. We don't have the capacity to do all of this by ourselves.
You can go to thetakeaway.org and see all of Dr. Levine's diaries and also hear all of our coverage of the Ebola crisis.
I often dream of trains when I'm alone. I ride on them into another zone.
Rolling across the world on the rails, you get to see it as you travel, an irreplaceable experience more than a century and a half old.
My name is Brian Gilchrist from Lincoln City, Oregon. My fondest memory of being on a train is at 17 years old, backpacking through Europe in Greece, traveling to Athens with some friends from France and Italy, being taught how to say I love you in Greek by a couple women in their early 30s. Oh, and we were drinking little bottles of ouzo as well.
There's The Murder on the Orient Express, an anthology for travelers on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Henry Kaiser wrote a book about crossing America on the California Zephyr.
It was very adventurous because they accidentally took the wrong track and started sending us to Florida. We weren't in a hurry, so it wasn't a problem. And it allowed us to see more of the countryside and just made it kind of an adventure. By far our best trip, and I would recommend it to anyone.
Thank you, Kenzie from Salt Lake City. And from Florida, I vividly remember an Amtrak trip from Atlanta to San Francisco in 2000. The memory lingers because of the colorful characters I met along the way. From the Air Force recruit who disembarked in the middle of the night at the Texas base to later serve in the Iraq War, to the couple that met and left the train together. Along the way, we hit a deer, a fruit truck, and even appeared to be moving backwards at night. And then San Antonio, Texas, can't forget 1974. From San Antonio to Mexico City, train ran out of water, so only beer was available. I was 9 years old. Later on the program, we'll talk with two brand new writers in residence working for Amtrak. What stories will we find? Call us at 877-8MYTAKE and be a part of the conversation or at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
I broke down in East St. Louis, the Kansas City line, drunk up all of my money that I borrow every time, and I fell down at the Derby. The night's as black as a crow. It was a train that took me away from here, but a train can bring me home.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Friday Movies. Christian Meinzer is with us, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Day podcast with Rafer Guzman, who is away this week. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi, John.
So what do we got? We've got three offerings here, two of them thrillers. We'll begin with The Two Faces of January, a mysterious title. Here's the clip.
Why don't you and I go downstairs, have a drink, see if we can come to an arrangement?
Unfortunately, I'm not authorized to negotiate with you. I'm just here for the money.
Viggo Mortensen. Love Viggo Mortensen. What'd you think?
Oh, and you're going to love him in this, too. He's playing somebody who has swindled some people in the States, and he and his very young wife, played by Kirsten Dunst, run off to live in Europe for a while and escape the law, but they run into Oscar Isaac from Inside Llewyn Davis, who may help them or may get even further tangled up with things. I don't want to give it away, but if you like The Talented Mr. Ripley, I think you're going to like this. It's based on Patricia Highsmith's novel, also called Two Faces of January. She also is the one who did Talented Mr. Ripley. So a lot of tension, not a ton of action, much more psychological anxiety in the whole thing.
And Kirsten Dunst is an irreplaceable piece of the zeitgeist, so this movie has to work. This next movie is, well, first of all, Denzel Washington, so it has to work because of that, and it's based on a TV show, which could be so a little iffy here. The Equalizer. Let's hear a clip.
He's not coming back. Had enough? Because I can keep going, brick by brick, dollar by dollar, body by body. Or you can call your boss and tell him to shut down his operation tonight.
Seems like Denzel Washington wants to get a little bit of this Liam Neeson
sort of
evil guy action here.
It's hard not to feel that way because this is the same kind of Liam Neeson movie. You left the system, but you're getting dragged back in. You didn't want to have to work for the law again.
Heart
you wanted to
gold.
Be an ordinary guy. But you're – and in this case, I have to say when I first heard about this movie, I thought Equalizer – isn't that scraping the bottom of the 80s barrel?
Pretty soon we're going to be like
T.J. Hooker, Simon & Simon, what's next?
Right.
But it's pretty fun at times. Really? He's really equalizing. Actually, he's more like exterminating. He's very fierce. I'd say my one issue with this movie is at times it feels like it really should be a TV series. He equalizes one guy. And then something else happens and he equalizes the next guy. And it doesn't always feel like the equalizing is related from one equalizing situation to the next. It should have been different miniseries, standalone episodes.
So picky. But they could make, 10 different sequels, right?
They probably will. I have no doubt about it.
So the takeaway here is if you like Denzel Washington, you'll like this movie, but it's basically a TV series from the 80s.
Yes, yes.
All right, Advanced Style. This is very different. A documentary and limited release today, and it's really based on an experience online that has become a whole narrative.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So there's this guy named Ari Cohen who began photographing a few years ago on the streets of New York the very fashionable older women who had walked down the streets in their 60s, 70s, all the way up to their hundreds. Became hugely popular, got turned into a book, and this movie profiles some of the women, and they're telling their own stories. You're hearing what they were like when they were younger, but you're mostly hearing about what life is like now, why they love clothes so much, what makes life worth living, and how you express yourself. It's really inspiring. It's a lot of fun.
You love?
I loved it. As somebody who loves older people, I'm already a sucker for this kind of thing. But anybody else who's going to watch this is suddenly going to think, I want to be 100 years old.
Blog becomes book becomes movie. It's a great new trajectory. What's on the podcast this week?
We are talking with Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast, about what kinds of movies work best if you're on a date for dinner afterward. So what's going to whet your appetite? What's going to get you excited to go on a dinner date after the movie?
Movies this weekend, The Equalizer, Advanced Style, and Two Faces of January. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the podcast. Kristen, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Breakdown, baby.
Friday on The Takeaway, let's do something different. Let's do it more than once, shall we? Welcome Sean Ramesfurum, host of Sideshow, a podcast from Studio 360, a terrific show here on WNYC and heard nationally. Sean, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So what we wanted to do here, and you're the guy, is do something called the Friday Five, and it's a way for allowing people who listen to The Takeaway who are essentially imprisoned by all of our mainstream stories and ideas like this one.
Today we're going to be doing the official iPhone 6 Plus bend test.
Okay, we watched it. 32 million people watched it online. Okay, I'm pretty edgy, right? But you've got a few options for us to listen to, check out, download, look
Absolutely.
At online that we might have missed this week.
Though I would love to bend an iPhone 6.
So. I'm surprised you haven't done it already. I'm surprised you haven't posted your own video.
I work in public radio. I need to find one. That's a lot of money. But so, yeah, I mean, this week was kicked off with a great new song by Kendrick Lamar, who is the most exciting rapper in hip hop these days.
This is a world. This is a world for me. This is a world for me.
I have been through a whole lot. Trial, tribulation, but I know God. Satan want to put me in a bow tie. Pray that the holy water don't go dry. Yeah, yeah. As I look around me, so many motherfuckers.
Thanks for the beep there.
Yeah, beeps continue.
Public radio, yeah, but smile on your face. You
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's these bubblegum guitars from the Isley Brothers.
Yeah, I thought that was Isley Brothers.
Yeah, absolutely. And apparently one of the Isleys came by and hung out with him in the studio and added some vocals to the original guitars.
Nice.
To hear this coming from him, and this is the first single from his upcoming album, which everyone in the universe is excited about, that listens to Kendrick Lamar at least. It was really surprising, and it was still, it still packed as much punch as all his other stuff, but with huge pop hooks.
Yeah, a happy 1 out of 5 Absolutely. On our Friday Five. What's next?
Number two is Key and Peele are back this week, as well as Kendrick Lamar.
That's easy. That's shooting fish in a barrel. They're great.
And they're promoting their new season, season 4, which kicked off, I think, this week on Comedy Central with shorts online. And the best of the three that came out this week was sort of a riff on the misconceptions of gay weddings.
Really, I just wanted to say basically that a gay wedding is just like a straight wedding. Yes, sir.
So then do the men wear dresses and then the women would wear suits?
No. You would just wear exactly what you would wear at a straight wedding.
Oh, okay. Yeah. There's a lot of them. There's, you know, when do we sing YMCA? Where do we get the euros to buy gay gifts? Do we throw something other than rice? And then the guy goes, like, what? And he goes, I don't know, couscous? What would you do?
All right, number three. Friday Five.
Yeah, and
Kirsten Dunst?
Sure, Kirsten Dunst. Another sort of public service announcement.
Are you Kirsten Dunst? Yeah, that's me. Hi, how are you? Cool.
So what's going on there is these two kids are driving up to Kirsten Dunst's house while she's waiting for a car to take her wherever, and they go, hey, are you Kirsten Dunst? And then they just walk up and start taking selfies with her. And it's an easy target, kids who are on Instagram, yeah, they're sort of hollow, whatever it is. But Kirsten Dunst really sells the short because she's left feeling really empty and hollow by the whole thing, and it's a simple message. Celebrities are just like us. They want a good conversation. They want to, you know, feel like they're making a good human connection, and when you just take a selfie with them, it's not working.
Number four,
two pieces of visual art to close this out. The hardest thing to talk about on the radio perhaps, but I'll do my best. The New York Times had a beautiful illustration this week from a guy named Anders Nielsen. He's a cartoonist from the Midwest. It's called Explaining My Relationship to the Totality of the Universe. It's this really elaborate graphic that tracks time from the Big Bang to the year 3,193,007,014. Nice take on how infinite the universe is and how small we are in it. That made you not feel, you know, bleak.
All right, number five. Here we go.
Malkovich.
This week we got a gigantic photo set of iconic photographs. We've got Migrant Mother, we've got Marilyn Monroe and Roses, naked John Lennon hugging Yoko Ono, but all of the faces in these iconic images have been replaced with the face of John Malkovich.
Malkovich?
And unlike every other celebrity meme we see online, or almost every other celebrity meme, John Malkovich helped make these photos. He got dressed up and did makeup and did hair for the photographer, Sandra Miller, and it is unsettling.
Really?
And very funny, but unsettling.
Well, I don't know. There's something reassuring about that sound. Let's listen to it again.
Malkovich.
It's very soothing.
Sean Ramesvaram, who's host of a Sideshow podcast from Studio 360. That's our Friday Five here. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
In the old days of new media, it was vintage content or pornography that launched a channel. HBO launched on old movies and eventually became Game of Thrones.
So many adventures. So much to be thankful for.
Now Amazon wants to reverse this formula with a new series, Transparent, which tells the story of a transgender parent struggling to come out to her family.
One more thing. I made a commitment here last week that I was going to come out to my kids, and I didn't do it because it just wasn't time. You know, but I will, and it will be soon. Yeah. I promise you.
Actor Jeffrey Tambor in the debut of Transparent, which is intended to launch a new Amazon channel, a partnership with AT&T announced just a few days ago. $39 a month. Subscribers get internet, HBO, and Amazon Prime. It's designed to appeal to young people. How does this business model work? Here to discuss Amazon's latest attempt to reverse the formula on new media is Brian Stelter, CNN's senior media correspondent and host of Reliable Sources. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
So they're really putting the cart before the horse here, trying something fundamentally new at Amazon. Are we ready for this right now, or are they doing something, you know, misguided?
It feels like this could be Amazon's House of Cards moment. And what I mean by that is, you know, about 18 months ago, Netflix was put on the map with original programming thanks to House of Cards. And Netflix had had other original shows before, and it's had others since, like Orange is the New Black.
Right.
But it was House of Cards that really crystallized people's awareness and interest around their programming. And this could be that moment for Amazon, too. Rarely have I ever seen so many universally positive reviews for a series. Not just critics saying it's the best show on Amazon. I've seen a lot of critics say it's the best show on all of TV this fall. It just happens not to be on traditional TV.
Hmm. And, you know, Netflix made its business model with old movies on DVDs mm-hmm. and then launched its streaming channel with House of Cards. And now it's known mostly as a streaming location.
Yeah.
Amazon will be streaming and downloads. How does Netflix deal with piracy? How does Amazon deal with piracy, for that matter? This seems like a curious...
Well, they're sort of aware that there's some password sharing, for example, that goes on among families, and that's something they have to live with. HBO has to live with that as well, with HBO Go, their version of a streaming service. If you have HBO, you can then also stream the programming. Amazon's even more unusual than Netflix, isn't it? Because to go from DVDs to streaming is one thing. To go from a online store for books to a television studio and distribution system is an even stranger sort of thing. The same place I get my toilet paper, I can also get transparent.
That's what we want in the 21st century.
Right? I guess that's not unlike a mall, right, where the multiplex at the mall is right beside the department stores. But Amazon's first attempts at original shows didn't go quite as well as Netflix's first attempts. They came out with a couple of shows last year, and they've had a lot more pilot episodes that have not gone forward. So this feels like the first time that they really have an opportunity.
Now, does CNN's programming come through AT&T as its sort of traditional cable service, or is Amazon trying to push the CNN brand as part of this whole package?
Well, I'm struck by what Amazon's doing, trying to be bundled as a part of this kind of lower tier package. There's a lot of experimentation going on right now about trying to get new people to subscribe to some form of cable by offering a slightly less expensive package with a smaller number of channels. But by including something like Amazon or Netflix in that bundle, these distributors are acknowledging the new world that is a much more on-demand style world where people want the programming as they can have it.
I wonder if that affects piracy as well. I mean, we just talked about Kendrick Lamar launching his first cut off his new album, which isn't out yet, online. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no concern about piracy there. It seems like the music industry has gone past this piracy question and it really is just happy with the idea that everything's going to be there in the cloud. Are movies getting to that point now, too?
Partly for Amazon. Amazon is they sell their television programming service as a part of Amazon Prime, which also includes free shipping, and it includes other little extras like free books on your Kindle. So the business model is so unusual. It's not as if you're just paying for access to Transparent or to another show they have like Alpha House. You're paying for all these other things as well. And so it's hard to tell how much of a priority their TV programming is. In other words, how worried are they about piracy if they don't have a standalone TV subscription service?
But the consumers who are coming to it have a whole range of missions, a whole range of services they're looking for, not simply movies.
Right, right. And that might be one reason why we haven't seen more success around Amazon's first original TV shows. But they are continuing to try, just like Netflix and just like Hulu. And there will be others like these three as well that will redefine what a television network is in the 21st century. Netflix increasingly is a TV network. It just doesn't happen to have a channel on cable.
Last question. Is Amazon really playing in the Google world more even than Netflix in the sense that they kind of want to be the brand that's everywhere, the sort of a boot up identity that you see on right. every device first, whatever it is you're doing?
Right. I think that's a fair comparison. It's Amazon, it's Google, it's Apple, it's Microsoft. And it's Facebook. When you're playing in that big of a league, you want to have as many different services and be competing in as many different ways as you possibly can. I noticed on Amazon when I was logging in this week, I'm using a 10-year-old email address on Amazon because that's how long I've been associated. That's how long I've had an account on Amazon. They have a lot of history with me. They've got a lot of data on me, and they can use that in a wide variety of ways. To have this kind of forward-facing television approach is in some ways sort of old-fashioned. But I understand why they're doing it, because they're going to get a lot of attention for a show like this. When you have critics saying it's the best new show of the fall, it's going to motivate a lot of people to go online for the first time and look at Amazon Prime. And maybe once they've watched Transparent, they're going to stick around and buy some more toilet paper.
Well, on the small sort of slice of this, it's absolutely the case that the quality of the programming on Netflix drove subscriptions.
Yes.
And if Amazon's looking for that,
yes,
a quality show will do that for them.
I've actually seen critics say that this is better than any show on Netflix. And that was a striking statement to make, I think. It's a reminder again that we're in a golden age of television. Of course, there's also more bad TV than ever, but there's more good TV than ever, too.
You know, during the last golden age, there was more bad TV than ever also. Brian Stelter, senior media correspondent for CNN and the host of Reliable Sources. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
I went around a train station, waiting for that train. Take me.
All aboard, says Jimmy. Here's a memorable railway story from one of you from Gloucester, Mass. Christmas Eve, coming home from a visit gone bad with friends with whom we were supposed to have spent the holiday. My daughter was 3. We had a little sleeper compartment. The Pullman porter hid her gifts for me and delivered them at dawn with a story of how Santa had landed the sleigh on top of the train. Santa with an electric guitar. Wow, great stories from memorable train rides. Train rides do lend themselves to stories. Stories powerful enough to erase a bad holiday visit with family or friends. Amtrak has really picked up on this idea. The passenger rail service has started a writer-in-residence program dedicated to the idea that you encounter great stories on trains, and at the very least, you get some writing done on a relaxed cross-country rail ride. There are about 24 Amtrak writers in residence, some journalists, a former CIA agent, a poet who's also a Broadway actor, 2 movie critics, 2 tech writers, a screenwriter, 4 award-winning novelists, a couple of professors, and 2 of our good friends, Farai Chidea, host and producer of the podcast One with Farai, and Marco Werman, host of PRI's The World. Marco and Farai, welcome.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Did you apply for this gig?
Absolutely.
Marco?
Yeah, it was. I heard about this writer residency, I think, on Twitter. Somebody tweeted about it, and I thought, 5 days on Amtrak? I'll try that. So, yeah, it's a very brief application process, a second round, and then we found out a couple of days ago, right, Farai?
Absolutely.
So what you get is, Farai, tell us again?
Well, you get a round trip on a long-distance train. It can be cross-country. It can be north-south. It can be diagonal. I think I'm going to go diagonal from New Orleans to L.A. So one
nice.
Of the long-haul scenic routes.
Is there a name of that train?
Sunset Limited.
Sunset Limited. Farai Chidea on the Sunset Limited.
It's pretty extraordinary. I was kind of like, oh, well, you get on a train and then you go somewhere. But if you start looking at the Amtrak routes, and this isn't a plug for Amtrak, but it's pretty amazing. The California Zephyr, which starts in Chicago and goes to Denver and on to Emeryville in San Francisco. The city of New Orleans from Chicago down to Memphis and on to New Orleans. I mean, how cool would that be? Just get your own sleeper berth and, you know, sit there and stare out the window and write. So that's why I signed up.
So, Marco, do you think we should hire some blues musicians to come with us just to keep things—
Definitely to play that Jimi Hendrix song, yeah.
So Farai's going to do the Sunset Limited. Marco, have you picked your route?
I haven't, but I am kind of thinking about, taking the Texas Eagle, which starts in Chicago, goes down to St. Louis and Dallas and San Antonio and then on to Los Angeles. And, thinking of ways to fold in kind of the brief of the world into this trip and kind of looking at the world in my own backyard and maybe making a few stops and meeting some people and tell those stories.
Well, you're such a dutiful host, Marco. Just ditch the world. Do like an acid novel or something. You know?
All right.
All right.
No, great. No taken.
Yeah. Does anybody know how Amtrak got this idea?
Well, yeah, there were a couple of writers. One of them, his last name is Chi, and I think it's Alexander. Do I have that right?
No, that's right.
Yeah. So Alexander Chi was talking about how there should be some kind of a writer's residency. And then another writer picked that up and started tweeting it, and Amtrak tweeted back at her. And so these two writers basically inspired Amtrak to actually ante up and make room for 24 freeloaders.
And say, yeah, freeloaders, hobos.
Yeah. Right.
And Chi was saying that this is the favorite place for writing.
It's a great place.
Like it is for many writers. I mean, you take the train, right?
I do, especially on the East Coast, and I'm excited to take it somewhere else than the East Coast. I mean, I've been a very dedicated East Coast train rider from Florida to Boston, but not really other parts of the country.
Marco, what are you looking forward to on that north-south route if you decide to take it? And again, we're not committing you to that at this point.
I mean, I'm thinking not just the train and being on the train and trying to meet people, because I like meeting people and like writing about them and, you know, finding characters. But, you know, getting off the train and kind of threading the kind of life of the train into the life of these stations and kind of the world around those stations. I don't know if that's going to be possible, but that's kind of what I'm aiming to do. I mean, one of my favorite train trips ever was in West Africa from Abidjan, Ivory Coast, up to Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso. And it takes, you know, a good 24 to 36 hours, depending on, you know, how many stops it makes and how long they stand there. But, you know, I met a guy who ended up by being a great source for me once I ended up living in Ouagadougou. And, you know, it's a very different life on trains in pretty much every country you go to other than the United States. But there's this kind of community that forms everywhere in the car that you're in. I'm really looking forward to that.
I'm hearing a weaving of that Burkina Faso trip and maybe the U.S. trip there, Marco, not to give you any ideas or to, you know, give you any bad ideas, which I'm always
I'm
happy
thinking
to
about
do.
It. Yeah? I'm thinking about it.
That sounds good. Fry, what about you? Project?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to do this, what I'm going to do, you know, in terms of like the venue. I do some travel writing for the New York Times, but the Sunset, basically starting in the early 1900s, there was a lot of immigration from New Orleans mm-hmm. to Los Angeles mm-hmm. in part because of a flood that destroyed some of the historic black neighborhoods. But there's just a strong tie between New Orleans and L.A., and I think there might be a piece in that or maybe a mini doc. Who knows?
You know, New Orleans, a lot of people don't know this in American history. It has been a kind of Ellis Island for immigration for hundreds of years. Going back to the 1600s, people landed first in New Orleans and then moved off into the continent. That is absolutely a great, great story. I love what you're talking about, Marco, with the stations. I think the stations are a great story. That's even true in Europe. The Orient Express stations, the Para Palace is the old hotel in Istanbul. There are hotels in Vienna and all through Europe that are associated with the Orient Express. But now that the Orient Express isn't that big of a deal anymore, I think the stations in the U.S. would be a great story, a sociological story, don't you think, Fry?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of these long-haul trains go through places that are part of the shrinking heartland in terms of population, and to get off in some of the less explored places would be really fascinating.
Let's talk about the food before we go, Marco. Are you worried or are you enthusiastic?
You know, my experience with food on Amtrak is the bar car between Boston and New York. It's not, you know, it's potato chips and pre-made sandwiches and a hot dog. Maybe I'll bring my own. I'm expecting that probably the quality of food will be a little higher in the sleeper cars. That's what I'm hoping anyway.
Well, I think the fact that if you even said you're going to bring your own, Amtrak people are already working to try to do something special for you. Fry, how about you?
Oh, you know, it's like I'm just looking forward to the whole experience. I think that for me, just being around people who are taking family vacations or big adventures is exciting. Mm. I love seeing other people's joy and their sense of exploration and trying to figure out, oh, is that the grandma of that little kid over there? And, you know, there's just it's a fertile place for the imagination.
When I just had two sets of twins and they were babies, we took two sleepers from New York to Minnesota. And the Amtrak employees were as much a part of the adventure as anything else. It was really, really spectacular. So have fun, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll have to, you know, get a diary from you as you're going. We'll talk to you while you're on the road when you get back. Fry Today, host and producer of the podcast One with Fry and a writer in residence for Amtrak. Thanks, Fry.
Thank you.
And Marco Werman, host of Public Radio International's The World. Of course, Marco, have a great weekend and good luck.
Thank you, John.
Both of them, writers in residence for Amtrak. You're kind of writers in residence for The Takeaway, aren't you? We hear your stories. We get your stories about rail and everything else that's on the program. If you want to respond to Adam Levine, our doctor on the Ebola crisis in West Africa, as many of you have done, please call us at 877-8MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. What a great week. We're at the terminal of the week right now. Thanks so much for riding with us this week. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.